final and third installment of Class War Battlefield Podcast's 2017 Year End Roundup. I'm your host, Ryan Meredith. Let's end this.
Staten Island's got me so upset. And California made me lose my rest. And everybody knows about Missouri. God damn. Hey, Cleveland's got me so upset. Louisiana made me lose. Can't you see it? Can't you feel it? Cause it's despair. I can't believe it. What's the meaning of it?
It ain't fair.
Are we invisible and worthy of fear?
Can't breathe.
Or is it that the people just don't care?
Somebody say a prayer.
Yeah.
I'm running out of words to describe what I'm feeling here. The pain and pressure, we bleeding. I need a medic here. But no medic can cure corruption of law, perversion of power. That body was sitting for more than 4 hours. Told him to rise. I could that black bird fly. Constriction of oxygen. You know how that man died. Right on candid camera. Guess the vantage point was out of their view. The powers that be overpower the power in you. Got authorities on my trail.
Goddamn.
School children sitting in jail.
Goddamn.
Politicians flipping that cash.
Goddamn.
Feel like every day is my last.
Goddamn. Brooklyn has got me so upset. And Florida done made me lose my rest. And everybody knows about Missouri. Goddamn. Houston has got me so upset. And Illinois done made me lose my rest. And everybody knows, goddamn.
Hey YouTube, you're probably mad at me. Hold on, chill out. For those feminists that clicked on this link and you're mad at me, just hold on a second, I've got a good point. I used to be a feminist too, so let's just slow down a little bit. Anyway, let's get into it. Welcome to Rachel Repeat. I'm Rachel, and get excited because today we're talking about feminism and why it is still racist. So first, let me give you my background and why I've come across this perspective. So in the beginning, I actually did become a feminist because there's a lot of good points, very important things that feminism is trying to change in our cultures. Gender equality, or even a lack of gender definition, that we have the freedom to define ourselves as we wish, and that the way our body looks doesn't define what we're able to do or how we're treated. Basically, I'm all for anti-oppression, which is what feminism is about. It's what everyone says it's about anyway. When I was in college, I was all about everything. I called myself a feminist because I thought the label fit. I was happy to carry a label that made me visible to people who wanted to know who an ally was to them. When I was in college, I was first trained by the government to be a certified sexual assault response advocate. So I was all about sex positivity and how to change the way we think about the way we treat each other and each other's bodies, and not turning each other into objects for selfish reasons and being able to see each other as human beings and treat each other that way. Important stuff, I think. So I was all for carrying the word feminist. I'll wear that. Absolutely, why not? I want people to know that I'm somebody that's against oppression. And then I took one of my most beloved classes ever in college, which was women's history in America specifically. And then I found out that the suffragist movement at the beginning, if you remember, there's a lot of issues going on. For instance, at the time that women were trying to get rights to vote, black men were also trying to get rights to vote. And some women worked well with black men and they were trying to do it together. And then black men got the vote and white women didn't. And the ugly side of a lot of white women came out saying things like why they didn't think black men should have gotten the vote before them, why they felt betrayed. A lot of really ugly perspectives came out. And then there were people like Margaret Sanger, the pioneer of birth control, basically. She created the American Birth Control League, which then became Planned Parenthood. Glad everyone's getting birth control. However, at the time, Margaret Sanger was all for joining the eugenics movement. She believed that it was important not only to provide birth control, but to sterilize the feeble-minded in reference to people of color, women of color. Bad day for feminism. And then we have the feminist movement where the word feminism itself came into play, which was the middle class white women that started feminism. Nothing wrong with that, except they tended to leave women of color out of the equation, not representing them. In fact, I've still had a lot of conversations with women that are not white today feeling like white women are a little bit threatened. This is still an issue, not just because black women and other women of color still feel like white women feel threatened by their power, but because why are we using a term to label ourselves that we know very well has a history of racism? What validates that this was such an issue is also the term womanism or womanist. These terms are very strong, hard evidence for the fact that black women and other women of color did not feel included in the feminist movement. Had to come up with their own word so much because they felt like feminism didn't represent them. When I found this out, I was feeling like, whoa, I'm supposed to be claiming this word so people know I'm anti-oppression for all people, not just women, not just white women, all people. So then I find out that feminism, even the word, does not represent anti-oppression as well as I thought it did. I was horrified at this idea. Now, to be honest, in the first place, I was hesitant to take on a label. I took it because I wanted people to know I was an ally like that. But I've always been hesitant about using labels because I feel like it encourages people to be lazy thinkers. That if you know what word I fall under, you think you know something about me. Nope. In the same way, I already had issues with how many feminists were using the word to express their anger towards men, and not just the men that had hurt them in their own experiences, but all men, labeling the entirety of the gender under the same assumptions. I didn't like that, and it was happening a lot, but I could understand because of some of the really horrific things that had happened to women at the hands of men. So I forgave it. But then to find out that you're making other women feel oppressed, you're making other women feel less than the way you're asking men to not make you feel, sorry, doesn't vibe with me. It has to have integrity or I'm out. And so, I'm out, guys. I'm not gonna call myself a feminist because the word is tainted. You can't. As a sociologist, I firmly believe that culture is about changing. In fact, part of culture is language, and language is always changing. Bootylicious is in the dictionary. If we're making up new words for the silly things, why would we not make up a new word for something that we all feel is incredibly important? Why would we not make up a new word to help incorporate people that we are claiming we care about? As a feminist, if you're going to claim to be anti-oppression for all, you need to look at how much your legacy is representing that cause and that goal and that priority. I believe if you really think you're a feminist, you will consider why you have not chosen a new word to represent you when you know this old word has racist roots. You have to be responsible for change if you want to make it happen. For this reason, it is disgusting that any of us are insecure enough to not involve and include women that look different from us in this movement that's anti-oppression. I need you to take very seriously how ashamed you should be if you have discluded women who look different from you from the movement that is supposed to be about equality. Now, with that said, it's okay if you're realizing you've done some things you shouldn't have done. If you're sorry about it, that's all that's important. If you're sorry that you have made a mistake and overlooked the way that some women have been oppressed by the movement that is supposed to be against oppression, then just acknowledge it and let's make it better. Let's lose the word feminist and all of the ugly racist history that's gotten attached to it, and even the ugly present history that's gotten attached to it.
I want to begin today by talking about what I expect most of you want me to talk about, given the emails I've already gotten. So let me jump right in before making any announcements whatsoever and talk about what's on everyone's mind. It is, of course, the election, and even more importantly, the result of that election, which is the 4 years of presidency that will begin in a couple of months for Donald Trump. And I want to address, since this is a program about economics, some of the economic reasons why Mr. Trump won that race and what it presages or suggests in terms of where we are going as an economy and indeed as a nation. So let me cut right to the bone here of what I think the problem is. The name of the problem is capitalism, the economic system that governs the United States, that shapes so profoundly our politics, our culture, our very daily life. I believe that that capitalism over the last 40 years has created a syndrome, a pattern, a behavior that culminates in the victory, surprising to so many, of Donald Trump. Let me explain. Over the last half century, or at least the last 40 years, capitalism in the United States has functioned in a particular way. It isn't unusual. Capitalism has functioned that way before, but it has done so with a kind of gusto, a kind of intensity, and a kind of relentlessness that has really shocked, particularly, the American people. What do I mean? Well, there are two basic syndromes, two basic behaviors of capitalism in the United States that I want to put in everyone's mind at the forefront. The first we tend to call automation. It is the desire of capitalists to increase their profits by replacing people with machines. Computers, robots, those are the fancy names, but it's an old process, but it really heated up starting in the 1970s in a massive way that has changed every workplace in this country and indeed around the world. But it has meant very starkly that capitalists, who had the greatest incentive, of course, to replace the most expensive workers first with machines and then work on down as the machines proved more profitable than paying those workers. So it was the workers who did the best, who had the highest salaries, who had won the highest wages, often with enormous struggles of strikes for 100 years, that were the targets. Automation whacked them but good for the last 40 years. The second way capitalists thought to make more profits over the last 40 years, that is stunning, was by what we can call relocation, moving production facilities, manufacturing, but now also services, out of the United States to other parts of the world where wages are much lower. Lower, in fact, in good part because of the earlier history of capitalism when it relied on colonialism and imperialism to fashion the rest of the world as providers of raw materials, providers of food, and providers of other necessary things for the capitalism to thrive in its center, Western Europe, North America, and Japan. Over the last 40 years, capitalists have left the United States in stunning numbers, decimating jobs, decimating the communities which used to live on those jobs. I often talk here about Detroit or Cleveland or Camden, New Jersey, or my hometown, Youngstown, Ohio, as examples of what capitalism has done. Again, getting rid of good jobs, high-paying jobs, unionized jobs in the process. So over the last 40 years, capitalism has delivered a body blow to the working classes of the United States. Men and women, white and non-white, skilled and unskilled. It's been a very hard time. The gap between rich and poor has grown back to the proportions it had at the end of the 19th century. It is an ugly economic landscape. Not surprisingly, the American people are agitated about this. They're suffering. They want to know why. But even more important, they want it to stop. They want this relentless damaging of their jobs, damaging of their wages, damaging of their job security, cutting off of their benefits, reducing the public services which might have offset what was happening to them in their wages. They want that to stop. For a while, they had the illusion it may have stopped when they became pioneers in the way of borrowing more money than any working class had ever borrowed before. And indeed, from the 70s into the early part of this century, the blow was softened as workers accumulated more and more debt to keep themselves going when their jobs didn't provide them with rising income. Debt for their car purchase, debt for their home purchase, debt using their credit card, and then the new one of the last 20 years, debt to send their kids to get a college degree, even as the value of that degree for getting a job shrank in direct proportion with the rising indebtedness of working class families seeking to do well by their children. Of course, in this scenario, the masses wanted change. And we began to see a pattern. Everyone running for president, Republican and Democrat alike, promised that he, since we only recently had had a she would be different. He would bring hope. For what? For change. Let's recall 8 years ago how Barack Obama decided on a slogan for his campaign called Hope and Change. Exactly. Every candidate had to try to appeal to the people suffering by saying, vote for me, I'm different. I'll make changes. I'll do something to stop or reverse what has happened to all of you. Every candidate tried it. I'm an outsider, they would say. I'm different, they would say. With each one that was elected, because he might be different, we have the same story. The promise betrayed. The different candidate turned out not to be so different at all. And that was true of Republicans, and it was true of Democrats. We were surprised 8 years ago that an African American could become the president. But in a peculiar way, he exemplified the same thing. He had an easier time making the point that he was different. His skin color spoke volumes in a country as beset by a history of racism as ours is. The very idea of a young black man running for president let us know something different was happening, something new was happening. When that new, different person, Mr. Obama, said he would make changes, millions of people swept him into office, the harbinger, they hoped, for change. Well, the fact is he didn't bring it. He couldn't, he said, but in any case, he didn't. You can blame many things for that. You always can. A recalcitrant Congress, insufficient pressure from below, bad advisors. You all know the drill. But I'm an economist, so I look for the economic dimension. And the economic dimension was that capitalism is a system, and as a system, it has a momentum, a structure, a way of posing and solving problems for itself. The president, by himself, cannot change that. Even if the presidents who've been elected, if we give them the benefit of the doubt and we say they tried to make change, and we're being generous, the reality is they failed. They didn't do it. We'll never know how hard they tried, but we do know they didn't make the change because wages remain stagnant over the 40 years, decline of job situations continue, loss of public services is only worse, the instability of capitalism got worse, culminating in the crash of 2008. The system dictates to the politicians, not the other way around. Why is this important? Because Mr. Trump, therefore, had a problem. The problem was he had to be different. He had to make a case that people have become very cynical about, and for good reason. Oh, another politician who says he's different. Mrs. Clinton was different. She was a woman. Her problem was that she was so stuck in the establishment of the Democratic Party and of the government for so many years that the claim to be really different was a tough one for her to manage. She didn't do that very well, and I'm being as kind as I know how to be. Mr. Trump, therefore, could capture, if he did it right, the mantle of, I'm really different. And that's what he did, and he did it well. I am different in every way. I'm not a politician, I'm a businessman. I'm not a politician trying to become wealthy, I already am wealthier than any of them get. And I'm vulgar, and I say outrageous things, and I act outrageous, and I shoot from the hip, and my Twitter account is full of things no other politician would dare be caught saying. That's a good way to suggest I'm really different. And I'm really going to talk about the suffering of the mass of people, and I'm going to speak against the globalization, the immigration that I can plausibly blame for the problems that the American working class has suffered. Not a good argument, doesn't deal with the reality, but at least it pretends to care. So here we have another candidate promising change, giving hope to the mass of the working class that maybe, just maybe, change is coming. And looking at the alternative, Mrs. Clinton, you couldn't think that, at least not if you were paying attention, even a little bit, over the last 20 years. That's why Mr. Trump won, because he had more to say to a population that is jaded about all this, doesn't really believe he will bring change either, and I'll come back to that in a minute, but there's more hope maybe there than there would have been of a Mrs. Clinton who is too deep in the same old establishment. And notice that Trump first savaged the establishment of the Republican Party. That's what the primary was about. That was his denigration of Bush. And then when he was done, he turned to Mrs. Clinton. He might have had a much harder time with Bernie Sanders, because Bernie Sanders' bona fides as different are captured by his willingness to take the word socialist as a description of himself. That sure makes you different, since every other politician who dared do that in the last 50 years thereby committed political suicide. So he was different, all right. He might have sustained it. But the establishment killed off that different candidate, as we now know. But that only established even more that she was the establishment who was hostile to the kind of talk that a Bernie Sanders put forward. And so that made it easier for Mr. Trump, yet again, to stick her with the label same old, and him with the prospect of change. I think that shaped the election. I think those many counties in the Midwest of the United States that are white, overwhelmingly white counties, but that voted in sizable majorities for Barack Obama 8 years ago, those same counties went for Trump this time. Racism is not the explanation here, nor is the sexism. Yes, there are people who are racist and sexist who love Mr. Trump. That's not the basic shift that brought him into power. That's an old part of the Republican constituency. The new part, the part we have to think about, is the part that changed once again. Not thinking there's much in it, but if you have to choose between these two, you give it to the weird Trump. The guy whose followers Clinton referred to as deplorables. That move of making them all wrong-headed, backward, that was a disrespect that cost her, and cost her a lot. Their anger isn't about their support for either racism or sexism. Their anger is about a capitalist system that has not served them well for nearly half a century, and it isn't surprising that they're angry and bitter and determined to try anything else, since they didn't have a left-wing criticism of establishment politics to respond to. They went and tried something else. Now let me tell you where this analysis goes. There is very little reason to believe that a billionaire real estate dealer, which is what Mr. Trump is a likely candidate to change this economic system. He's done very well in it. He's done very well by it. He has not done anything in his life or history to suggest that he is up to even understanding how capitalism is the root problem he's just cashed in on, let alone changing it. But even if he did try, and we will see soon enough, the chances of his being able to change this capitalist system when all of his predecessors failed, at least those who tried, there's even less reason to believe in that. So my guess is that Mr. Trump will recapitulate exactly what happened to Mr. Obama and to those who came before Mr. Obama, who promised hope and change in one word or another. That's what I think we're likely to see. And let me drive the point home. These days, there are folks, particularly on the left, who use the word fascism to describe Mr. Trump, or at least where they fear Mr. Trump may go. Let's take a brief look at German and Italian fascisms, Hitler and Mussolini. When they came to power on mass movements that were deeply loyal to them, that they had worked to build. Yet they, too, had to come and make their peace with the capitalist establishment of those two countries. They could not have done it alone, and they could not have done it against those capitalist interests. So they cut a deal with those capitalist interests. Study the history, you will see it. They proved that they would be good supporters for capitalist enterprises' profits, and the capitalist enterprises, in return, agreed to support them. They were afraid of a left, which was powerful at that time. Mr. Trump, having no movement of his own, will have to make peace with the capitalist system he now presides over. And they're not afraid of a left, at least not yet, in the United States. So they're ready to bargain, but not to Mr. Trump's convenience. He's got his work cut out for him. The economics of this situation don't bode well, no matter what he does to placate his right-wing supporters along the way. We are in for rough times. What Mr. Trump has said he would do will damage the lives of millions and millions of American people, from the decimation of the Health Care Act to the kinds of people he's likely to put with the Republican Party control of Congress onto the Supreme Court and all the rest. Suffering for sure, but able to change the capitalist system? I don't think so. And therefore able to escape what has dogged every other president in the last 40 years, the rage and anger by the end of his term or terms, because he has betrayed once again the demand of the people, which is, even though they're not yet ready to say so, for a different system that will not treat them in the same way. Because lying beneath all of these events, political and otherwise, is a rage against the machine, to borrow from Tom Morello. A rage against the capitalist system that is working in a way to make the 1% very well off indeed, and pretty much everybody else worrying, if not already in the deep trough of economic decline and of economic difficulty. We are in for hard times, and no one says it better than the amazing winner of this year's Nobel Prize in Literature, Bob Dylan. So let me read to you one stanza of one of his songs. "And what'll you do now, my blue-eyed son? And what'll you do now, my darling young one? I'm a-going back out for the rain starts a-falling. I'll walk to the depths of the deepest black forest, where the people are many and their hands are all empty, where the pellets of poison are flooding their waters, where the home in the valley meets the damp, dirty prison, and the executioner's face is always well hidden, where the hunger is ugly, where souls are forgotten, where black is the color, where none is the number. And I'll tell and speak it and think it and breathe it, and reflect from the mountain so all souls can see it. And I'll stand on the ocean until I start singing, but I'll know my song well before I start singing. And it's a hard rain that's gonna fall." So much for the election. By the way, Bob Dylan wrote that song in the 1960s, and he could have written it yesterday. That's usually a sign of having your finger on what's going on.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, this is your brother Vladimir Dees. Welcome to another episode of the Class War Battlefield Podcast. Great news, great news, great news. Getting closer to that rollout. That'll be the beginning of the year. Going to have some really exciting stuff to talk to you about at the beginning of the year. Can't believe it's only a few, literally about 3 months away. Let me mention first that I am pre-recording this, so when you get it, it's going to be edited a bit. I don't, as I've often stated, I haven't stated it in a long time, though, so I'll state it now. I do not edit my words. I will not edit my words. The only time when I'll edit my words is if I'm reading something verbatim and I mess up significantly enough where it ruins the flow. So I'll edit that. But other than that, what you get on here is what I am thinking at the time when I'm recording it. So I tried recording this a couple of days ago, this episode a couple of days ago, and there was a very powerful, about 10 minutes of it, where I was just hitting all the right notes. And then there was some drop-off, and I didn't end up finishing the recording, but the first 10 minutes was important enough where later on I'm actually going to play it. So be ready for that, because, you know, that will come up. This episode is, of course, about Las Vegas, as you can already see, and you're probably already sick of hearing about it. But ladies and gentlemen, as you always know, when I talk about something, I talk about something in a dramatically different way than other people. And I try not to do that just to be different. I don't like to do that just to be different. I don't like to do it for matters of shock purposes. I do this because this is truth-telling at its finest. I don't claim to have all the answers. I don't claim to know everything. I don't claim to know close to even a quarter or a tenth half the time of everything. But perception and intuition, two highly manipulated skills which we as human beings and humankind and mankind sometimes even, but very rarely man, have. And much of our survival depends on us using perception and intuition correctly. When we do not use it correctly, when we misuse it, when we misabuse it, guess what happens? We cease to function properly. We interact with one another in disconnected ways. We shatter each other very easily without consciously thinking about it. We become harder. And in many, many, many imperceivable ways, but very perceptible ways, we start to die. Pieces of us start to die, wither, deteriorate. Like the walking zombies that so many people love to watch on television, we become walking corpses, falling apart when intuition and perception are not used properly, when they are manipulated to the point where they intern within the host who's using them. Perception and intuition comes from a part of our being. Not ourself. Ourself is something complete. It's not completely different, but it's within the being. But perception and intuition come from two portions of our beings. There's 14 in all. The Egyptians believed there were 9. Or at least spoke of 9. But it comes from two specific portions of our beings, which helps promote and project what the world, or excuse me, not promote and project, but interpret and then promote what the world is actually communicating to us. Not only through our environment, but the natural realm also. Important. Important. Because right now, many people are talking about conspiracies. I've listened to a couple of them. Many of them make logical sense. Some of them even make intuitive sense. But I want to speak to you about something that is
Not even conspiracy for me. It is often said when there's a drumbeat of consensus, you know there must be a lie somewhere. I guess it's not often said, but I've heard it before. Old man told me this years ago. Right before the United States went to war with Iraq. Second time. He said, man, I'm not a college educated. I ain't really high school educated. I dropped out in like the ninth grade. But man, when there's this much of a drumbeat of consensus, there's a lie somewhere. There's a lie somewhere. You notice when speaking about Las Vegas, what does the news media keep saying? What does the news media keep saying? We don't know his motive. He never had a history of this. We don't know his motive. He never had a history of this. We don't know his motive. He never had a history of this. They keep saying that over and over again. They print it everywhere. They say it everywhere. His brother goes on the local news. Well, he didn't have any of these major weapons that, you know, you're finding and blah, blah, blah. He wasn't even really a gun guy. He may have had one or two handguns, maybe a rifle, but he wasn't really a gun guy. Excuse me. Wait a minute. Back up. Move it back a little bit. He's not a gun guy. He may have had two handguns and maybe a rifle. Sounds like a gun guy to me. He's not in law enforcement. He's supposedly not military. Okay, so let's take him. Okay, he's not law enforcement. He's not military. What the hell do you need two handguns for? And what do you need a rifle with that handgun for? You're not taking a handgun out to go hunting, are you? Okay, the rifle you can say, well, I'm using it for hunting. Okay, fine. The Brad blog reported that this gentleman, this coward, was from a little town in Las Vegas. I actually wanted to look it up. But the shooter reportedly was from Mesquite. Now, I got to tell you, ladies and gentlemen, I have to apologize. I'm not as ready for this one as I thought I was. But, all right, let's see. Brad Blog reported that this man who was from this little town, Mesquite, either this town or a town which he was vacationing in, actually sent reinforcements to the Clive Bundy people in Oregon, or was actually in the process of doing it. And he reported this on Monday. I've heard nothing more of it. Now, this is important because there is video, of course, on YouTube, which suggests that there might have been a second gunman. Now, earlier I was stating that the media had this drumbeat. It was, he was a lone gunman. There is no motive. We don't know the motive. And he had no history of this. Well, this video is somewhat distressing. It's somewhat distressing because it suggests that that's a lie. But more, there are facts now that are coming out which suggest that it's a lie anyway. This man, 64-year-old real estate man, who used to sell real estate, checked into multiple hotels surrounding that square using the same name all with views in that concert. I want you to think about this, ladies and gentlemen. I want you to think about this both logically and intuitively. If somebody tells you that a man, and by the way, this is not just some, you know, low totem pole realtor with a little bit of money. This guy was set. He had nothing to worry about. Tons of money in the bank. So you're going to tell me that this guy just suddenly wakes up one day and says, I'm going to kill a bunch of people. Let's be real about this, ladies and gentlemen. He checks into multiple hotel rooms around the square. He has 19 high-powered guns in his room. 19. What does this say to you? That this was a one-man job? What this says to me is, this man was likely meeting other men who were going to carry out a simultaneous, multi-angled attack on a group of people. I don't know what happened. In fact, I don't know if we can be sure that it didn't happen if it wasn't two people because of that other video. But I'm not even going to go down that road. Let's say, okay, it was one person. One person with 19 guns. What was he going to do with them all? He had to know from the angle that he picked that he would be able to be spotted and spotted quickly. The windows, when you remove them, you can actually notice that they're gone. If you take a look at the pictures of the building, it's not difficult to see that they're not there. They're specifically colored in a certain way that when you remove them, you can see that they're not there. I want you to understand this, ladies and gentlemen. This suggests that there is a conspiracy to carry this out. This whole idea of, oh, he was a lone wolf. Let me help you out with that. Because I'm tired of hearing about it. What does the whole concept of he was a lone wolf actually mean? Seriously, have you actually sat down and thought about this? He was a lone wolf. That means somewhere there is a pack of other wolves prepping up, getting ready to mount a full-scale attack. More coordinated, more dastardly, more underhanded. Either to cause more casualties, or specific casualties in order to cripple the herd without totally destroying it. That's what they are telling you. And what they are saying then is that this one wolf decided to take it upon himself to forget about crippling the herd. We're just going to thin it out. Done. When they talk about lone wolves, this is what they're talking about. Oh, no. We're telling you there's wolves, they're saying. There's not only wolves, but there are packs of wolves. There are hungry wolves that are stalking you, about to murder you, but they're going to do it in a way that frightens the least amount of you. And as long as you're a good herd person, we're going to just take out the bad one. Maybe periodically we might have to take out an innocent one by accident. But we're going to leave the herd alone mostly. I mean, this is what they're telling us every time when they say this. Oh, well, he's a lone wolf. Dylan Storm Roof. He's a lone wolf. Well, okay, he's a lone wolf. Was he the one taking those pictures of him in the middle of the woods? Well, he just set up the camera. Every single picture, he just set up the camera. Okay. The Intercept, for the last couple of years, don't know if you've ever been to The Intercept. If you haven't, start going there. They've been running information. I'm kind of waiting until like one day when they just say, oh, you know, we're going to go mainstream, flip. Because I've started noticing CNN kind of mentioning them every now and then. It's like when Amy Goodman started appearing on CNN and stuff. You started noticing Democracy Now become a little bit more commercial. So I'm waiting. But for now, they're doing excellent, amazing work. So go there, check them out. But they've been running these stories periodically about how the federal government, the FBI, and other law enforcement agencies have been saying for years that the right-wing extremists in this country pose the greatest terrorist risk. They've been saying this for years. For years. They've even said that the Ku Klux Klan and other right-wing terrorist groups have infiltrated. This is FBI talking. They've infiltrated law enforcement. They have infiltrated law enforcement. So let's really honest to God think about this. I ain't saying this is how it happens, but ladies and gentlemen, it's time that we start thinking outside of this darn box. This mainstream media box. I want you to think about this. So you have a group in Las Vegas, actually in Nevada, a right-winged militia group who has some axe to grind not only with the government but with the general populace, as most of these groups actually do. It's the millennials who are killing our country. I've heard so many right-wingers say it. They hate their own young. They hate their own young. But so you have them. They have this axe to grind. So now they start planning to attack. And they say, well, where can we do the most damage? Where can we do the most damage? And they pick something like this. You 20,000 people. The fact that you only had around 500 people injured and 59 dead. Thank God. Because it should have been worse. So they picked this place. A few of them get cold feet, don't show up. The one guy who does says, well, take one for the team. And lets the bullets rain down. So now he's dead. Las Vegas, really good police department, unable to solve Tupac's murder. In the middle of a desert, has no idea how the man died. Couldn't even catch his murderer. Helicopters everywhere. Couldn't catch his murderer. But so, you know, but they're not corrupt or anything. Las Vegas is not known for its corruption. Keep that in mind as you listen to this, because, you know, the first thing you're going to want to do is, you're crazy. But seriously, think about this. So, officers come in. Now, these reports have not said how far up these right-wing elements have ascended in law enforcement. We already know. That they've ascended high and deep into the military. Thanks in part to George Bush. But in truth, they've always been there. There was a little bit of a purge in the 1980s. But they've always been there. So you get police officers in there gathering information, gathering evidence. Guys who really want to find out what's going on. And then you got that other element who's covering the tracks, making sure evidence gets lost, making sure you put a kibosh, or they put a kibosh, excuse me, on what is actually evolving. And so what ultimately happens is you get detectives and such who are on their way to finding out the truth, and they get stopped by a captain saying, listen, man, I understand what you're going through, but you got to stop. The feds are taking over this. We need to let it go. Let it go. This is hotter than what you want to deal with. Let it go. What would happen? Because I know, most of us, we don't want to believe this. Which is funny, because today, you know, today most people admit, look, JFK was killed by a conspiracy. Most people will admit RFK and MLK and Malcolm X were conspiracy killings. But outside of that, it's difficult for people to see, or to admit, should I say, that there are larger conspiracies that are happening that are costing civilians their lives. If you knew, let's say the federal government, the news agencies, whatever, came out and admitted he was not a lone wolf, he was part of a well-coordinated terrorist group of white people in this country, the conversation on terrorism would change overnight. Because then it would be about discovering how they got there, why they turned their backs on America, blah, 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 yak, 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 lie, lie, lie. Because, and this is dangerous. This is dangerous because just like with the opioid problem, it was a, when black people were addicted to opioids, when brown people were addicted to opioids, it was a degenerate problem. It was because these people were inferior and that's all they could do. That's what they are about. When white people became addicted to opioids, it became a sickness that needed to be treated. They needed to find out why they were going to opioids and then to develop treatments that would actually help not only them, but their families. This is the same thing with terrorism. If law enforcement came out and said this guy was part of a terrorist group of white people, terrorism would have to evolve. Because that then means white people are capable of terrorism, and, you know, you go anywhere around the world and anyone will tell you that. But then you got to deal with why. But even beyond that, what would that do to the psyche of the nation? When you have to look around and start saying, is the person next to me a right-wing terrorist? Because then that calls conservatism into question, full-blown question. Then you have the question if conservatism itself leads to terrorism, because the media has been getting away with the lie that to be left is to be terroristic for 100-plus years. They've been saying for over 100 years that if you are left and you are radical, then you are violent. When the reality is the most violent, the most degenerative parts of this society have been right wing. And they have been unashamedly and unabashedly right wing. They will tell you that. So to actually have to confront that, and don't get it twisted, please don't get it twisted. That's what this is about. They will not tell you that this was a coordinated effort between right-wing nuts. Because that changes the dynamics of terrorism and how it is broadcast to the world. And it also changes the potency of conservatism. And this needs to be understood. At this moment, I'm going to pause here. I'm going to play that part, that introduction part that I was telling you about. Then I'll come back on the other side. A little bit more commentary. And then we'll wrap this sucker up. All right? This is Vimer Deese.
On this episode of China Uncensored, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, step right up to witness the showdown of the century. Place your bets now. Hi, welcome to China Uncensored. I'm your host, Chris Chappell. It was the showdown we were all waiting for. The world's two biggest economies contending for the title of world superpower. Last week, the leader of the unfree world and head of the Chinese Communist Party, Xi Jinping, met with the leader of the free world and head of the Mar-a-Lago Palm Beach Preservation Society, Donald Trump. The whole world tuned in to watch the two-day fight at Trump's Mar-a-Lago estate here in Palm Beach, Florida. Donald Trump expected it to be very difficult. A high-stakes gamble for both sides. No patty cake playing here. It was head-to-head, mano a mano. Dare I say, a real face-off? But the most important question for this epic showdown is, who won? So today on China Uncensored, we'll be giving you a blow-by-blow rundown of the match. And the two contenders are out. Trump arrives at West Palm Beach Airport with a crowd cheering his name. Definitely a point for Trump. She arrives at the same airport. Sorry, Xi, not as flashy. But wait, he's a gentleman, taking his wife's hand as they walk down the jetway. Point for Xi Jinping. Okay, so they're tied, but I'm sure that will change. Let's move on to the most hotly anticipated part of the summit, the all-important handshake. Trump is famous for his patented yank and pull style of handshake. And the occasional no handshake. How will Xi Jinping handle it? Shoot, let's see if there's another angle. Trump goes in for the yank and pull, but like a Tai Chi master, Xi effortlessly steps in to absorb the handshake, meeting it with a firm handshake of his own. He had extensive training from China's National Department of Handshake Defense Techniques. So that's a point for Xi Jinping. Next, the family meeting. Ivanka Trump brings out her 5-year-old daughter, Arabella, to woo Xi Jinping and his wife with a traditional Chinese song. Trump gets a point for having an adorable granddaughter. Oh, and Arabella didn't sing just any song. Apparently, that song was a favorite of former Chinese leader and Xi's staunch political enemy, Jiang Zemin. Trump gets another point for having a political mastermind for a granddaughter. What did the Chinese side offer as a comeback? Showing off the power of Chinese collectivism, busloads of Chinese nationalists came to welcome Xi Jinping outside his hotel. Or maybe they just got lost on their way to a Star Trek convention. But wait, what is that terrible music they're blasting? It sounds like the theme song for Battle on Shangongling Mountain, a propaganda film idolizing China's fight against American troops during the Korean War. The song slanders U.S. troops as wolves and goes on to say, if the ravenous wolves come, those greeting them have hunting guns. Bad form. But that's still a point for Xi for largest volume of supporters. But then I also have to give Trump a point for his supporters, who make up for their lack in numbers with a whole lot of enthusiasm. Showing off the power of American individualism, this guy. The driver is winning so much, he's probably sick of winning. And it's a pretty close match so far between Trump and Xi. So, what did they talk about on the first day?
So far, I have gotten nothing, absolutely nothing. But we have developed a friendship, I can see that.
Friendship? Friendship with China doesn't have much political value for Trump. He's already got friends, loads of friends, the best friends. But for Xi Jinping, friendship with America is a huge propaganda coup. So a point for Xi, and it's looking like a tie. Shoot, that can't be right. This was the epic showdown between the world's two biggest economies. Superpower meets superpower. There's got to be a winner. Hold on, Trump still has a trump card to play. Syria. While enjoying a fancy dinner of Dover sole and New York steak, and definitely not the McDonald's he threatened 2 years ago, Trump launches a missile strike against Syria, punishing Assad for his chemical attack on civilians. Boom! Trump shows Xi that he is a man of action. And it backs up the threats he made earlier last week that if China is not going to solve North Korea, we will. Plus, it knocks the wind out of the claims that Trump is a Russian stooge. 3 points for Trump. Okay, now this is getting interesting. Moving on to Friday, when Trump and Xi sat down to have that candid, frank conversation they were both looking forward to so much. First, what didn't they talk about? Apparently, no mention of Taiwan or the One China policy. Point for Xi. What about the South China Sea? Well, according to Secretary of State Tillerson, Trump brought it up, but didn't really say anything that Xi Jinping can't just ignore. So actually, that's a point for Xi. What about human rights? Something that Trump was urged to bring up during the meeting. Tillerson said that Trump also noted the importance of protecting human rights and other values deeply held by Americans. Well, that's good. But when a reporter asked Tillerson whether the Trump administration would pressure China on specific human rights violations, here's what he said.
As to the discussions around human rights in China, I think America's values are quite clear, and they really occupy the core of all of our discussions. I don't think you have to have a separate conversation. They're really embedded in every discussion.
So human rights are part of being Americans, so we don't have to separately talk about human rights because we're American. I'm going to interpret that as a no, we did not talk to China about their human rights violations. I'm disappointed in you, T-Rex. Another point for Xi. And the two are tied again. Now comes the contentious North Korea issue. 90% of the rogue regime's trade is done with China. But getting the Chinese Communist Party to turn on its little brother has been difficult. But at Mar-a-Lago, Xi Jinping agreed that action had to be taken against North Korea. Probably launching that missile strike on Syria helped Trump get his point across too. Now it looks like China is taking some action. They just sent back North Korean coal ships as part of UN sanctions. And they're also talking again to South Korea about hitting North Korea with more sanctions. That is a solid point for Trump. But it's also a win for Xi Jinping, because giving the appearance of being tough on North Korea prevents the US from acting on its own, which would have put China in an awkward spot. Plus, Xi Jinping already wanted to contain North Korea, so this is a good excuse for him. I'd say it's more of a win than a concession, so Xi deserves a point for that, too. Now, how about trade? Surely someone will break this tie. China has enjoyed a huge trade surplus with the US for more than two decades. Last year, it stood at $347 billion. And all those exports have been propping up China's economy. So Trump comes into the ring with harsh rhetoric about these trade imbalances. At the meeting, according to Financial Times, Xi Jinping offered the Trump administration better market access for financial sector investments. Xi Jinping also agreed to lift China's 13-year-long ban on U.S. beef and buy more American grain and agricultural products. And to further sweeten the pot, Xi and Trump agreed to a 100-day plan for trade talks to discuss how to handle China's trade surplus. So that's a point for President Trump, because he got the Chinese to make big trade concessions. But it's also a win for Xi Jinping. In a masterful move that can only further demonstrate Xi Jinping's knowledge of Tai Chi, he absorbs the blow and redirects it to his advantage. See, by making these concessions, Xi Jinping avoids the trade war Trump has been threatening. And the kicker is, he does it for practically nothing. All these concessions to Trump are actually things the Chinese government was already working on with the Obama administration. So, another point for Xi, and we're tied again. Really? No, this cannot end in a tie. There has to be something else we can look at. What about their outfits? Or their wives' outfits? Who won best dress? Who won best tie? Or the walk they took after lunch? Who won the walk? What's that, Shelley? What do you mean the scoreboard only goes up to 9? We need to know who won the summit. Fine. There's only one way to settle this. Rematch. Trump accepted Xi's invitation to visit China later this year. There, he will enter the Dragon's Court and once and for all determine who is the world's sole superpower. So stay tuned and be sure to subscribe to China Uncensored. You can also watch us on Amazon Fire TV, Roku, or Apple TV. Well, unless you're in Taiwan or Hong Kong, Apple has decided we're illegal in both of those places and removed the China Uncensored app there. If you think that's points off for Apple, take a moment to click the link below to sign a petition demanding Apple allow viewers in Taiwan and Hong Kong to watch China Uncensored on Apple TV. Thanks for your support. Once again, I'm your host, Chris Chappell. See you next time.
Our gross national product now is over $800 billion a year. But that gross national product, if we judge the United States of America by that gross national product counts air pollution and cigarette advertising and ambulances to clear our highways of carnage. It counts special locks for our doors and the jails for the people who break them. It counts the destruction of the redwoods and the loss of our natural wonder in chaotic sprawl. It counts napalm, and it counts nuclear warheads and armored cars for the police to fight the riots in our cities. It counts Whitman's rifle and Speck knife and the television programs which glorify violence in order to sell toys to our children. Yet the gross national product does not allow for the health of our children, the quality of their education, or the joy of their play. It does not include the beauty of our poetry, or the strength of our marriages, the intelligence of our public debate, or the integrity of our public officials. It measures neither our wit nor our courage, neither our wisdom nor our learning, neither our compassion nor our devotion to our country. It measures everything in short, except that which makes life worthwhile. And it can tell us everything about America, except why we are proud that we are Americans.
Speaking of Flint, Michigan, it looks like Governor Rick Snyder, Republican Governor Rick Snyder, he who does not believe in democracy, when the Republican legislature in Michigan, in Lansing, passed a law giving the governor the power to topple elected leaders and replace them with handpicked cronies who would have all the power of elected leaders, the people of the state of Michigan got together, did a ballot initiative, and undid that law by ballot initiative. So Rick Snyder and his Republican cronies in the Republican House and Senate in Michigan, in Lansing, passed a new law, and included in that law not only was his ability to continue appointing emergency managers, little dictators, but also it said that this law cannot be repealed by referendum. Seriously, not making this up. And so he got his emergency managers in. And now it looks like the reason why Flint was put on Flint River water instead of Detroit water, you know, the excuse that is being used by Rick Snyder and other scumbags in the Republican Party in Michigan is that, oh, we were just trying to save $2 million, maybe as much as $8 million. You're trying to save money for Flint. It turns out, as these emails are being released, that the Detroit water system proposed an $800 million savings to the city of Flint, 20% over moving to Flint water. In other words, it would have cost less for them to stay with Detroit water. So clearly, Republican Governor Rick Snyder is a lying scumbag. But beyond that, what is he lying about and why? Well, it looks increasingly like what he's lying about, is that they were planning on taking the Detroit water system, breaking it into two pieces and privatizing them, selling it off to some of his billionaire buddies, which is what he's already done with a lot of the other assets of Detroit, including Belle Isle. So that some libertarians can create a little libertarian paradise there or something. And now on top of that, the Washington Post, Mark Guarino reporting, if lead-laced water supply wasn't enough to deal with, many residents of Flint, Michigan face a new crisis, replacing the water heaters, pipes, and even the service lines to their homes that may have been damaged by the city's water. And for now, it's unclear whether they will receive any help in covering those costs. Now, this is one of the poorest cities of its size in the entire nation. Flint used to be the manufacturing epicenter for General Motors, right? The biggest GM factories, the first big, you know, organized labor automotive thing in the United States, the great Flint sit-down strike of, as I recall, 35. It was back in the 1930s, and it echoed on from there, and Flint was just rolling along, and a middle class, both a white and a black middle class, were emerging in Flint. People were moving from all over the country to Flint because that's where the jobs were. And then, of course, we got Reagan. And we got Clinton. And we got permanent normal trade relations with China. And we got NAFTA and CAFTA and the WTO. And what happened to Flint is the same thing that happened to Detroit. It's the same thing that happened to Baltimore. It's the same thing that happened to city after city in America, happened to small towns all across the South and up and down the East Coast. What happened is all those jobs went to Asia. As Bernie Sanders has pointed out a million times, just since George Bush became president, just in the last 16 years, we've lost over 60,000 factories. Just in the 8 years of George Bush's presidency, we lost over 40,000 factories. Factories, not jobs, factories to China. And that doesn't count the tens of thousands of factories that we lost from the mid-80s when Reagan started this madness until 2000, because nobody was keeping track of it back then. It wasn't until after NAFTA and CAFTA and SHAFTA and everything else that people figured out, hey, we're getting badly screwed. So it's pretty amazing. And now, by the way, Johnson Controls just merged with, what's the company they merged with? It was Tyco, just merged with Tyco and moved their headquarters over to Ireland. Now, if Johnson Controls sounds familiar, it's because their principal customer were GM and Chrysler. They make car parts. They're going to continue to make car parts. It's just that they're going to put their corporate headquarters in Ireland so that they don't pay American taxes. I realize this is illegal in most countries. But see, here in the United States, our laws are written by lawyers who work for billionaires and for big corporations. And they hand those laws to mostly Republican, but occasionally Democratic members of Congress as well, and say, here, pass this law for me. And here's a campaign contribution. And so this is legal in the United States. It's illegal in most other countries, but it's legal here in the United States. And by the way, Congress approved a bailout plan. As Andrew Ross Sorkin is writing in the New York Times today, Congress approved a bailout plan worth almost $80 billion for General Motors and Chrysler, saving the automakers and indirectly suppliers like Johnson Controls. By 2010, with its business back on track, see, we bailed them out, you and me, with our tax dollars. Routed $80 billion into that industry through GM and Chrysler, and much of it went back to Johnson Controls. And by 2010, with its business back on track, writes Andrew Ross Sorkin, Johnson Controls doubled the pay of Stephen Rowell, then its chief executive, to more than $15 million. With your money! Despite the federal government's rescue and hundreds of millions of dollars in tax breaks, Sorkin writes, over the last few decades from states like Michigan and Wisconsin, yes, Michigan and Wisconsin taxpayers have been giving hundreds of millions of dollars to Johnson Controls. Johnson Controls said on Monday it was renouncing its United States corporate citizenship by selling itself to Tyco International, which has already based itself in Ireland. It's all about the oligarchy. Right? The governor of Michigan, Rick Snyder, is willing to poison thousands of children, tens or 100,000 Flint residents, in order to be able to break up the publicly owned water company so they can be privatized so his billionaire buddies can get richer. And Johnson Controls is willing to move their corporate headquarters to Ireland after we bailed them out and kept them alive. It's a giant screw you to America from Johnson Controls. And, of course, this is all made possible by legislation promoted by Republicans. When the hell is this going to end? When are we going to say America for America?
Well, ladies and gentlemen, that concludes the 2017 Class War Battlefield Podcast Year End Roundup. Thank you for a great year. Thank you for lending me your ears. Thank you for the contacts. Thank you the gig, K-Gig, K-G-I-G, and, you know, I can never remember the other one. There's another one that is similar to K-Gig, but I always have to look that one up. I love, if I could just quickly say, I love that name, Gig. I really hope they run advertisements which say the gig, because it really just kind of rolls off the tongue. Anyway, the other one would be 93.3 KPHD, and of course 104.9, that's FM 104.9 K-Gig, the gig. Guys, if you ever need a commercial, by the way, if you need a promotional spot, for Class War Battlefield Podcast, if you're running it, please, first and foremost, if you're running it, I'll say it again, if you're running it on a community station, which, by the way, I apologize, I didn't go through and I didn't edit anything in this one, so I know you can't really run this one unless you do some editing yourself, but if you are running it, I guarantee in the new year, with the new format, there's going to be a lot less likelihood of such things as that getting in without being edited. But I just didn't really have the time. So, again, if you are running it, let me know. If you need a promotional spot, send me the details, and I'll cut a promotional spot for you. Again, reach out, let me know. I'd love to hear if you're carrying the show. If it's on a website, if it's not a radio show, but a radio station, but a website, also let me know. I'll have no problem calling you out either and putting your name up. I'm very happy to be anywhere where I am. But please let me know. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much again, guys, for your ear, for giving me a great year, and for even putting up with my indulgences. I know some of the episodes were not easy to hear. But as I always say, I try to be truthful. I don't want to be like everybody else. I don't want to... too many people won't tell the truth. And so, I don't want to lie. I really do want to tell you the truth and give it to you raw, if need be. Because we need that today. So, again, this is your brother, Vimer Deese. Peace to all of you. Peace to your homes. Peace to your families. New website coming. New information on the podcast coming soon. Very soon, in the next month, in fact. So, look out for that. It's been a great year, y'all. Have a happy new year.
There's a shadow on the faces of the men who sent the guns to the wars that are fought in places where their business interest runs. On the radio, talk shows, and the TV, you hear one thing again and again: how the USA stands for freedom, and we come to the aid of a friend. But who are the ones that we call our friends? These governments killing their own, or the people who finally can't take anymore, and they pick up a gun or a brick or a stone, and they're alive.